Hey Dan, this is Seth Wars from Channel 9 coming to you from Building 25. I'm here with Jared Parsons. Tell us what you do, my friend.
So, I'm Jared Parsons. I'm the compiler lead on the Roslyn team. So I run the C#, F#, and VB compilers. I've been in languages at Microsoft for about 11 years now, mostly on the actual language teams. I've done a little bit of research, and I've been back now for a couple years.
So that's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about compilation, because when I was in computer science school, it was one program I ran that told me if things worked or didn't, but it seems like it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, so these days, languages are not just compilers anymore. Languages are ecosystems. And that is really kind of what the Roslyn project was about. Before we started Roslyn, we basically had these really nice command line tools, and the IDE, every release of Visual Studio, needed more and more data from the compiler. And the architecture of the native compilers just weren't there for that. Mm-hmm. Roslyn was kind of born of saying that we're going to look at language as an API. And we're going to say the compiler is one team that takes that API and gives me data. The IDE is another team that sits on top of that API and provides an amazing development experience around the language.
And this is an interesting thing, right? Because traditionally, my understanding of a compiler is I take some stuff that's code that we understand, and it translates it into, in the case of .NET, missile code, right, intermediate language, or in the case of others, some bytecode that will tell the computer what to do. So I guess I have a little bit of a sort of a brain freeze of what more is there than that? Because you mentioned the IDE team. What is it that they need from the compiler that maybe someone in the command line does not need?
I mean, what you're kind of explaining is exactly what my team would love to do. If we could just deal with, like, give me text, give me an DLL,
easy problem,
it'd
right?
be great. Yeah. It would be simple, it would be awesome. The problem is, and that is our experience, like we get 99% of the time that compiler gets great code and they want to produce DLLs or EXEs. The IDE, though, kind of has the opposite problem. The IDE spends the majority of their time looking at bad code because every keystroke you type, like every time you open a brace, your file's not parsable anymore until you close that brace. And so the IDE, like they want to be able to look at bad code and still give you good data. Like, how can I provide IntelliSense on a method overload when half the braces in the file aren't lining up? What do I do when the next line of code creates another giant parse error? And that's kind of the drive of the IDE team, is giving good experiences on bad code, and the compiler team wants to give you good code, good DLLs for good code.
And I think maybe for the audience, maybe for me, it's lost on me why that's such a hard problem. Maybe we should start talking about what a parser or what a compiler actually does, mm-hmm. how it actually works, and then why the problem that the IDE team wants to solve is even harder given those constraints.
Well, I think it basically works as we're parsing is all about taking the text you write and breaking it down into what are the classes, what are the methods, what are the local variables, what are all the things in the middle. And so, in order to do that, we have to go through the structure, match closed braces to open braces, and things like that. And like for instance, when you do, like, you have a method name in, you have an open brace. Mm-hmm. The compiler wants to go parse out the return type, the name, the set of arguments, look for this brace, and say, okay, now I have the set. Anything in here is local to this method. And this is what the compiler team likes to see. The IDE team, though, they often see that. So if I have a method, if I have this here, and it's like number, is this a field? Is this a local? If someone accidentally types a close brace here, like where do these things go? And how do we basically look at this error condition and provide a good experience for the IDE on top of it? Like the IDE, like if you just type straight the bottom code, this is what you're going to get, and how do they give an experience over that?
I see. So here's where my, again, because I wrote, I'm embarrassed to say, I wrote a JSON parser last week just because, you know, everyone has the time for that kind of thing. It didn't take very long. But what's happening is I'm getting a stream, and I'm literally checking characters, creating tokens, and then matching them up. But when I hit a curly brace, my stream reader is going to keep looking for another curly brace before it actually produces the tokens that I want. How do you jump out of that and say there's something wrong? You know, because what's going to happen is it's going to go void and then it's going to go to the end of the class.
Yep, that's the fun of compilers is finding the error recovery, is looking at common patterns that people create when they're typing code and finding ways to break out of them and recover from it. And brace matching is a big one. And mm-hmm. That's an always fun problem that we have to deal with, and one of the places we had to tweak in terms of perf lot, bringing up Roslyn.
The other question is, because matching curly braces is more like a token thing, but now when we're talking about semantic views, for example, they're using a token that's never been defined, and that token might be defined somewhere else, and then in the absence of other tokens, how do you make sense of this and say, you know what, you haven't defined number yet, or the scope of number is outside, or for example, this curly brace is wrong, and how does this, I'm trying to wrap my head around this.
It's kind, some ways it's a problem it depends on which problem it is, but with like curly braces, we just introduce error recovery. The compiler can look ahead so far and say, clearly a brace is missing here, let's end this method and just start parsing from the next line. Mm-hmm. In terms of missing data, we can say things like, well, for instance, if you have, like, let's say you used var here. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you have like var x equals closest curly here, some other method. Well, if this method isn't defined, if we can't define this method, what do we tell the IDE about the return type of this guy?
Right.
And it's just about picking good error recovery and known things of saying like, well, this might be an error symbol if this method's not defined, or we'll just give it the type object so that you guys can continue providing IntelliSense. We'll tell you this is defined, there's a variable x, but its type is, meh. And the IDE then just has to have a plan for when the compiler gives us these error symbols or when the compiler gives us these data, like, we just have to pick the best experience possible. And sometimes we special case it based on the type of feature being used. But in general, it's more about just finding these error conditions, giving them the right data, and letting them kind of build on top of it.
So as a programmer, I'm imagining like tons of like switch and if statements. I mean, is that what the compiler is?
Well, the compiler has a lot of, if you go down to the binding layer, there are a lot of ifs and a lot of switches too.
So now that we've talked about sort of the structural, how the compiler sort of tokenizes stuff, the data structures obviously behind Roslyn, which is a radical change, and hopefully we'll get to that later on, the data structures must be very powerful in order to support the kind of experience that you want. Why don't you tell us about how Roslyn changed the way we look at those data structures and what those data structures look like?
So the biggest change we made is in how we expose files, essentially what are our syntax trees. The trees that Roslyn gives back from a file are fully round trippable. So So fully round trippable means I can take a file, parse it into our syntax trees, and syntax trees will tell you things like there's a class declaration, there's a method declaration, here's a local. I can take that syntax tree and put it back to a file with 100% fidelity. And so if I parse a file and put it back down, it will have byte for byte the exact same text.
Okay.
And this is extremely important to us because this is how the IDE works. Like, they want to be able to round trip files back and forth. We want to be able to program against them. And this is ingrained incredibly deeply into our code base. Like, it's actually the way our code base is structured. Every time you parse a file in a unit test, at the end of parsing, we actually restringize it and then do a byte by byte comparison in debug mode. It's like, it is ingrained
so
deeply.
So not just like a string compare, you're literally looking at bytes.
Yeah, it's all the way down to the very lowest level. Like, we kept the encoding the same, we have all of these things. It's very ingrained into our system. And the other thing, which is kind of unique to the Roslyn compiler as compared to the native, is these trees are immutable. So that means we can parse a file, get a syntax tree, and we can hand it out to any other piece of code in our system, and we have no fear that it's going to be modified, it's going to be changed, and we're going to end up producing the DLL for the actual code that the user wrote. Now, this was not true in our native compiler. We had mutable trees, and people thought it was fun in some places, like IntelliSense, to, oh, I'll just fix up the parse by rewriting the tree just a little bit. And if they did that incorrectly and it made it to the backend compiler, you could get issues. But with Roslyn, we know that the trees are going to be the same.
So people that are watching are thinking, but wait a minute. That should be okay, right, to mutate the actual tree. But in the context of Visual Studio, there might be other things that are expecting this tree, and mutating the tree could cause issues. What kind of issues were you experiencing?
We don't want those issues.
Yeah.
Like, one of the big things Roslyn also did is analyzers. So users can plug their own diagnostics into the compiler pipeline. We give them our trees. Like, Roslyn's an API. We hand them our raw syntax trees and say, hey, here are the syntax trees, or hey, here are the symbols. You guys do your analysis. You emit all the errors that are important for your DSL or your scenario. we're giving them our internal data structures to use. If we gave them a mutable tree and they mutated it, like, is that okay for screwing up the compilation? If the user wrote a class and they delete it, that would be a really bad thing if we didn't actually emit that class. And so it was important to allow us to freely flow the data without having to do a full copy every time we handed it to a different customer. And so it's just insulation for our own purposes.
So are these immutable data structures shareable across? Is there only one? I'm thinking about memory pressure on the system.
Yeah. So the way our parse trees work is we have this concept called red and green trees. And the idea is that if it was a fully mutable structure, that would mean that on every keystroke, we completely reparse the file and do a completely separate tree, and that would have killed perf.
Sure, absolutely.
So what we do is we actually have the tree, we call it red and green trees, and the reason we call it red and green trees was because that was the color of the markers we were using when we diagrammed it on the board.
Nice.
Someone had a red and green marker.
Yeah.
We also had red-blue trees at one point.
Fun fact.
Yeah, really important, and that terminology is actually very much baked into our code base.
Awesome.
If you get into the internals, but the way we have it is we have our trees structured into nodes which basically know how wide am I and what are my children. And then we have nodes which say that I know my position in the file, and I know about these nodes that basically just know their width and location. And what that does means that on keystrokes, all the nodes which just know basically my text, what is my length essentially, those can actually be reused between parses, because if you start typing spaces in front of, like if I put my caret here and I started typing space, like that method token hasn't changed. None of this has changed. The only thing that's changed is the position of those tokens within the file.
Oh, I see, because you want to give back the exact same string. And so you also got to maintain where positions of the tokens are.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the responsibility is divided in our trees. And we have the trees that understand the position, the absolute position in the file, and we have the trees which just understand like what the text is
right.
and its relationship to other nodes. And that means that we can reuse a lot of these tokens across every parse, and it helps to keep the memory pressure lower than it would have been.
I see. So you're kind of like, I'm thinking, because I've done a lot of videos on React recently,
yeah.
And React, what it does is it's when you push down data, it actually only changes the objects that need to be changed, and that's what you're essentially doing,
yeah.
Except they're all immutable.
Yeah.
And so when you're getting stuff back from the compiler, you're getting a bunch of immutable data structures, and as they change, they're just sort of pushed up.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a observably immutable data structure. So we still build the tree very lazily as you walk it, but from the perspective of the user, it's an immutable tree. But if you actually look under the hood, you can see us like poking things and basically realizing the tree as people are kind of walking down it. And that's another aspect that's important for perf, because a lot of times people are typing really fast and there's no reason to realize the entire tree unless someone actually looks at it in the space of those keystrokes.
So it's truly functional in the sense that it's immutable, but it's also lazily sort of expanded out.
Yep.
Okay, that's awesome. So let's get back now to the history of Roslyn, because Roslyn is sort of and the way I put it is the compiler was the basic unit of everything we did in Visual Studio and everything we did in C#, everything we did in .NET. You essentially picked up the house, pulled out the foundations, and then sort of reinserted Roslyn into the mix. What
yes.
was the decision making behind that, aside from the IDE wanting an experience and the compilers wanting an experience?
It was mostly just around, a lot of it was generated by the IDE. I mean, if languages were just compilers and ecosystems didn't really matter, the compiler team would have been happy to continue to develop C# in the C++ compiler. It was a very well-maintained code base. It had a very clean architecture. There were some rough spots, but overall, it was a really nice piece of code to work with. And it was super fast. The problem is that the pressures of all of the rest of the ecosystem drove us forward. Like, look at instance for StyleCop. StyleCop is a great type of tool that people want to develop for the ecosystem of C#. They can't reuse our C++ parser.
No.
They don't want to write StyleCop in C++. They want to write StyleCop in C#. So what did he do? He wrote a C# parser.
Yeah.
And this was a theme that we saw. Like, if you looked internally at Microsoft, there were a lot of C# parsers walking around because people just needed this much piece of data from it. They just wanted to like run some scripts on their code base and get back some data, do some little refactorings. And then our own IDE team, same thing. They were basically faced with a situation where Visual Studio kind of largely started as a native application, and Visual Studio has been migrating more and more to managed code over time. And especially around 2010, VS 2010, that's when the WPF editor became the core of Visual Studio.
Right.
So now you have Visual Studio at the core has now switched to this managed application that has these beautiful services. The WPF Editor is one of the,
it's an amazing
piece of architecture for it. And then we had this native C++ code base that's just desperately like trying to sit on top of it. And that managed code is driving all kinds of new scenarios for us, like taking snapshots, working, snapshots being the biggest one. How do we have symbols that, you know, if we give this managed interface back to someone else and it's backed by native memory, this managed interface can live for a very long time.
Right.
And it was really stressing out kind of the ecosystem. And at that point, we kind of said, we really want to have this experience that we have now of looking at the compiler as an API, having this managed code, and being able to build all of these services on top of it. Like, look at all these people who've built a parser. That was wasted time. We should have given them a parser that they could have used for that tool. And that was kind of the inspiration for Roslyn. And even up in the 2010 release, we had projects going on at that time in parallel where people were looking, like, what would it look like if we rewrote the compiler in C-sharp or VB? Mm-hmm. And F-sharp at the time was coming along, proving that you could have a managed compiler in the IDE, and it was great.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the genesis of when Roslyn started, was right around then. I think at the end of the 2010 release is when we really kind of said, we're going to do this. We're going to dedicate a large number of resources and make this happen.
I bet, though, like that must have been tough, right, as you're sort of lifting the entire infrastructure.
Yes.
What were some of the fun things that you experienced?
Well, I think there's a lot, like both putting it in the Visual Studio was a lot of fun because you have to do, in order to even get like colorization working, like you have to spend so much time. You have to get the parser working. You have to get this binding working. You have to get all of this groundwork laid before the IDE team can really do anything. So it was just a whole lot of like an enormous amount of front-loading work to get to the point where we could actually start writing services on top of it and then turning them on and even getting it to the point where we could start to dog food it.
I see.
And I remember some of the challenges are when we first started dog fooding it, it was slow. And
well, you went from C++ to pure C-sharp managed, right?
Yep. And there was just a lot of experiences around that. The bad thing was when we first turned it on, it was slow. Like you could type really fast and like nothing would colorize. But the good side was, if you waited, it would actually come back and colorize eventually. Nice. And it proved, it probably would seem terrible to anyone who didn't work on the team, but it was a good proof of our whole overall concept that we can build these asynchronous services, they will schedule correctly, and it will all come together. And then once we could dog food, then we started, you know, profiling, finding the bottlenecks, and got it to a much more palatable experience very quickly.
My favorite unit test of Roslyn, I put in air quotes unit test, is you actually use Roslyn to compile Roslyn, is that right?
Yes, and we on our Jenkins, so Jenkins is our CI system for our open source project, and we actually changed it last year so that whenever you submit to the CI server, it actually is a two-phase. The first thing it does is it builds the compiler. Then it takes the compiler, puts it over there, deletes all the binary directories, and then recompiles everything using the just-built compiler. So we dog food from the ground up.
And that's crazy.
Interestingly enough, that actually catches about one bug a month that
really
would have prevented us from compiling our own code base.
I mean, that's got to be super interesting, right? Because my sense, I've heard this, and this might be anecdotal, is that when you went from the C++ compiler to the Roslyn compiler, we'll pause there. When we went from the C++ compiler to the Roslyn compiler, you actually found bugs in the old compiler, but that you had to backport to make sure those bugs still worked in the new compiler. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So what'd you find?
Lots, just strange. We found very interesting bugs in like basically how does constant folding work in the compiler? And like where do we fold constants, where do we not fold constants? Nullable was a big one where we found just all kinds of little itty bitty tweaks in it. I guess in terms of like specific bugs, for me the bugs that really stand out is in this kind of learning experience, because when you come into this project, you're like, oh, we'll find the bugs and we'll replicate them. And if we like, that's just work. And then you actually encounter some of these bugs and you find out, we can't replicate this bug. There's just no way. And like we have, for instance, found bugs. And this, it's a very corner case in language, and I'm sure very, very few customers ever hit. But we're like, where VB, that we ended up, the choice of members, because we have a problem where VB is case insensitive, and it has to deal with the case, and C-sharp is case sensitive. So it's very possible for like C sharp to define an enum that has values name and name.
And that's perfectly legit.
That's perfectly legit. VBcant has to make a decision here because these identifiers are equivalent. And we found a corner case in one of these places where it had to make a decision that the tiebreaker came down to the address of the string allocated in memory. And it just so happened in VB that the way the allocator worked, it was consistent and always produced the same behavior. There's no way to replicate that in Roslyn. Like, how do we replicate that, like, a bug in the compiler came down to a tie break of a pointer in memory? Like, there's no way to replicate that.
No, because you don't have pointers in
We don't have that allocator. We don't have any of that.
What did you do? Did you say,
We ended up running a lot of tests of this and found out that we could pretty reasonably predict it would always be this value. It was actually, the particular problem came from a DLL Microsoft had authored. So we were able to go through and look at, take the native compiler, run it against all the projects we knew that ran it, and look at it, and it just so happened it always produced one of the values, so we switched the tiebreaker to be consistent with some other tiebreaking rules that we had.
That's awesome. I think the fun thing, particularly with Roslyn, is there's already so many other binaries out there that you can verify that Roslyn was actually working with a lot of things internally.
Yes, and we had one of the big things they did originally when they really started focus on compat was we basically had the big pile of tests. We had all of these repos that we knew we could compile with the native compiler, and we just took it and swapped Roslyn in, and we basically would compile with the native compiler, compile with Roslyn, grab the binaries, bring them back, and diff them, and say, did we produce the same warnings? What did we diff the binaries to make sure that we produced the same IL? Which is challenging because Roslyn actually produces a bit different IL in a lot of cases. But one of the things we were super concerned with is overload resolution. I always joke that compilers are about 5 to 10% fun and 90% overload resolution problems. Nice. Like, there's just no human can understand it except like Eric Lippert and John Skeet. That's not that.
Yeah.
Even us compiler devs are pulling out the spec. And it's a really easy problem to get wrong. And the worst part about getting overload resolution wrong is it either will cause an error for the user and they'll complain, which is the best possible case because we didn't ship bad code. The worst case is if you get overload resolution wrong and it silently picks something the user didn't expect. Like if you break tiebreakers the wrong way, it'll pick, like basically they would go from compiling with a native compiler, they compile for Roslyn, we change the overloads, and their code would start behaving differently. That's essentially the nightmare scenario. And one of the things we did with these tools is we compiled very large code bases, and then we went through the overload resolution decisions by looking at the core metadata and seeing like which token did which compiler pick, and using that to really drive out bugs in the compiler.
And by resolution, you mean like, for example, if you have inheritance and you got to pick the right method?
Not even inheritance. Like if you have two methods, which simply say like, you have one, which takes an int, when we call this method, which if you say m of 42, obviously you'd want to call this method.
Yeah.
If you say m of hello, you'd like to call this. And that's the core problem of overload resolution. This is an extremely simple example. There are really complex problems that come up with what if there's a conversion from this type to this type? What if there are generics involved?
Implicit conversions and stuff.
Yeah, when you have named and optional parameters, how does that, the spec has a very detailed breakdown on how it works, and then the compiler has copies of the spec embedded in it, and the notations where we say, this is what the spec says we do, but we don't do that. We actually do this instead.
Interesting. Were there cases where you looked at the old compiler and found that it did stuff wrong?
Yes. Absolutely.
What did you do moving forward? Because you wanted to have this sort of compatibility.
The deference is always to compat, especially with overload resolution, because it's tricky. The only times we went away from compat and overload resolution when it was just so clearly a bug and the result was just going to be so bad for the user, there could clearly be no one depending on this because their code would be blowing up in their face constantly.
Oh,
like that is. Other than that, like even after all the work we put into it, we shipped Roslyn. We found some overload resolution bugs that people sent us, and we went back and corrected them, and in general went back to the native compiler behavior.
That's awesome. There should be like a blog post every week on, look at what we found the old thing did. If you wrote this code, I mean, I've seen puzzles from certain people where they're like, okay, what does this do? And you're like, I don't know. What does it do? What does the spec say? And what does the compiler do? There's got to be a place where you blog all these things.
They occasionally pop up on individual developers' blogs. I've blogged about a couple of them in the past, but I think it would be nice if we put some of them out there.
Just for trivia, man. That'd be fun.
Oh, there are, yeah.
So let's go on to the, because we've spent a lot of time on C Sharp. Obviously, VB, and does F Sharp use Roslyn as well, or is F Sharp has its own compiler?
F Sharp has its own compiler. They were, I think C Sharp and VB started in the late 90s. F Sharp started more in like 2005. And when VB and C Sharp were coming along, there was no CLR. There was IL, there was actually a thing called Cool.
Oh, I've never heard of that. What was it?
Cool C. This was the, when it's like you're at a point where you're like, we're going to bring up a virtual machine, like a virtual runtime. We're going to bring up a compiler. We have this intermediate language. And so it's a whole bunch of, everyone has to like get to a certain point before you can start talking to each other.
Of course.
Cool C was this language that they wrote, which was just like just enough of a language that you could write like IL in. And it was a very minor language so that people could just start bootstrapping as fast as possible.
That's interesting.
And that's kind of the precursor to C Sharp.
Got it. So let's talk about VB then in the context of Roslyn. Mm-hmm. When you're writing VB, obviously it's a different sort of parse, but in the end, are the data structures the same as they would be in C Sharp?
So the parse trees are very different for both languages because they're fundamentally different languages. And in the past, there were things like Code Model, which tried to kind of merge them together, and it never worked. And we found the best way to separate them. There are a couple of core data structures that the language share. Like we both share the same the base syntax node and the base syntax token. And so we have the same underlying structures and underpinnings, and we actually have a lot of shared infrastructure for our parsers. But the actual parse trees are extremely different, and they're both meant to be full fidelity and very expressive for each language.
So if you're going to write your own sort of analyzer and you want to write it for C Sharp, you have to write one for VB as well because the data structures are different.
Yeah, in general, yes. If you have anything that depends on syntax, you'll always have to write two.
Okay.
If you have stuff that is more symbol oriented, like if I just want to say that I have a field and I want to say that it's never written to, and if it's never written to, please tell the user, make that read only. Today you would still kind of have to write two analyzers. There's actually work going on in Update 2 to have a layer which is language agnostic, which is focused much more on like operations. Like, I don't care that C Sharp expresses add with an arithmetic expression and two lefts, and VB calls it just something else. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a much more like combined level where it's like, this is an add this is an operation, we're adding, here's the left and the right. And it's a more general thing where you could write essentially the majority of what were the FXCOP rules on top of Roslyn once for all the languages.
So let's talk about now, just to shift gears, the difference also, because Roslyn is very different than it was before, but then there's this added difference of, hey, we're going to make this open source.
Yes.
At the same time. And so it feels like those two things are huge things, because open sourcing something, is it as easy as just saying, here's a public GitHub repo? Why don't you talk about that whole thing?
It's not that easy. So Roslyn had some advantages going into this. Roslyn is not a project where they walked in one day and said, guys, open source it. It was a project that really from the start, the intent was to open source it one day. It was kind of the, maybe not a like an explicit goal, but it was the hope of the team. And so it was meant developed in that way with some of that intuition in Ryan. And Roslyn actually went open source in stages.
I heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the first one is, I mean, the history of the Roslyn code base is it was internal to DevDiv. It was in TFS behind, you know, inside the Microsoft Corp network, and we went to CodePlex first. CodePlex was the big reveal. We put basically the compiler and some of the services, a little fraction of the services on CodePlex, probably about 30-40% of our code base. And that required a bit of engineering to work because CodePlex is Git.
Yeah.
And we're still developing, like, we're developing in TFS actively, but it's actually in Git. And so it wasn't really open source at that point. It was more source open. Like, people could read it. They could do PRs to it. But even when you did a PR to our repo, what we did was we took your PR, we hand-pushed it into our TFS repo, ran our little script that we had that would change our TFS commits into Git commits, then we'd like change the author to be the person who did the PR.
Sounds like fun.
But it was amazingly terrible and yeah. for everyone involved.
Shoelace and duct tape, people.
Oh. And there was great ones where we'd forget to run the script for a week and people would yell that Roslyn hadn't done anything in a week. Like, it was just terrible. Yeah. But when we went to GitHub and we did make that move, like, that was a huge engineering effort for us because we were picking up from nominally still living in TFS, still, we basically had our code. Our code internally was literally structured into two directories called open and closed. And basically, this was the Roslyn repo. And you just had to know, if I type anything into here, it's going to eventually go to CodePlex. And if I type anything in here, it'll never go to CodePlex.
Well, then when you were like building the thing, it had to be really weird kind of...
Yeah, there was no like validating that you could build this directory without that directory was hard. And we actually had a lot of, warts in
our
code.
It's the reason why PowerShell was built for this exact task, right?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Like, we had cross references here that we were kind of munging. We were kind of like tweaking our code as we synced it to Git. But then we said, okay, this is the wrong way to do it. We want to be on GitHub. We want to move our development from TFS over to GitHub, and we want that to be our first class experience.
So when you say that, you mean that whenever you're writing code and you finish something and it goes through CI and everything's working, when you commit, you're actually committing to GitHub and not to TFS and this wacky process.
Yep, and that was when we went to GitHub and open source. Like, basically the day we turned on our GitHub repo, like, that's what we were doing. Like, our entire, we picked up, we literally like left work on Friday one day, and then I stayed over the weekend. And Monday morning, people came in, and it's like, GitHub is now your source of truth. This is where we're going to do all of our development.
How long did it take to move that? Because you had to merge these, obviously.
Well, it took about a month.
Okay.
And the reason why was more of, when you're presenting to GitHub, when you're presenting to the larger community, you get embarrassed about things.
Sure, sure.
There are hacks that are okay when it's just between three or four friends.
That's right.
When you're showing it to a million people, you're like, we had customized XUnit, like, we had like made some changes to make it work better with our suites. We had a lot of internal things that we didn't want to publish because they were terrible. And so a lot of our precursor work was, we basically said, okay, we're going to go to GitHub. And then we spent about a month to a month and a half getting rid of the things that we wanted to be clean and nice for the open source experience and for our community. But it took about a month of kind of moving the architecture around, and then we kind of flipped the switch overnight and started work on Monday.
So is there still aspects of the compiler that are closed because they have proprietary stuff that we can't in good faith put out?
So now we've kind of switched. I said we had about 30 or 40% before. One of the things we went to GitHub is we took almost everything in the closed and moved it to GitHub. So all of our Visual Studio integration, our debugger work, our scripting, all that stuff, which was never on CodePlex, we just said, we're putting it all out now. There is still about like 5% of our code that's closed, but it's code that talks to our internal perf machines. Like, no one cares.
Yeah.
It's proprietary in that no one wants to see it. And we still have it just for a couple of internal semantics, but for the most part, it's not used.
And that makes sense, right? Because there's certain things, if you're going to be using Roslyn, there's only certain things that you need to use. Like, for example, I do open source, and the other day I just started deleting methods that have no references, that are internal or private. Why do I need them, right? I thought I might need them. Might as well just take them out. And so I like that idea. So let's talk about now how you actually manage the project, because management now becomes different when you're in the open, because you might have someone give you code from the outside.
It's not might. It's quite often. we get a lot of contributions to Roslyn, and it's awesome. Please keep doing it, guys. Yeah. I think management comes down to more of, it's like I said, it's kind of this thing where with the hacks and the other thing, when it's between friends, when you've got like eight people in a room, you could all say, this is what we're doing, guys, and you can walk away. When you have thousands and thousands of people looking at your code, like, that doesn't scale and it's not acceptable.
Right.
It forces you to be much more upfront with what your process is. And it also forces you to simplify them greatly, because any step in the process can be screwed up. Mm-hmm. Multiplied by more people, you're going to have more mess ups and more complaints.
Yeah, yeah.
And so part of the management was basically being very clear, like, what are our coding guidelines? What are our style guidelines? What is our PR process? What is acceptable to change and what is not acceptable to change? I want to add a language feature. How do I do that? Like, basically starting to document all of our processes and forcing us to do them all ourselves. And a lot of it was community driven. When we open sourced, we did not have it as simple as we wanted it. And people were pushing on us saying, "This is I actually read the documentation you wrote," which was great. And it was wrong. Oh, no.
Yeah. And so can you fix it, please?
Yeah, can you fix it? And people were pushing on us. And so the management was much more around, one, getting the processes in place and saying, like, this is how we're going to build. This is how we develop things and documenting all of our processes. And in particular, we did have to address, like, how do we handle community contributions and how do we get the SLAs signed off and things of that nature.
That makes sense. So now when you have an issue, for example, that comes up or you find a bug, are you literally creating issues in GitHub?
Yep.
And other people are creating issues in GitHub?
Absolutely.
So let's go through the workflow of, I've been working with Roslyn and I found an error. Mm-hmm. What would be the process for me to actually tell you about it in a meaningful way?
The way we users do is generally just open an issue on GitHub. They file an issue on GitHub, give us an explanation of this is the code that I wrote, like, and you hopefully it's a minimal sample, as short of samples possible, say this is code I wrote, this is the error I got, and this is what I was expecting to actually happen. And from there, it's a bug, and we start triaging it. We usually assign a dev to talk to them about it and figure out, is this actually a compiler bug, or is this, you know, user misunderstanding of compiler behavior, or kind of working through the process, and then we triage it, put it in whatever bucket we're going to fix it in, and get to work.
That's awesome. Can you tell us some of the sort of pull requests that you have gotten, some of the issues that have been really helpful?
So we've gotten a lot of, let's see, I think we've had, like, one of the things that we've punted a lot of is error messages. Like, error message clarity is something that we haven't had a lot of time to work on. We've been really pressed for time, and that's something we're like, okay, we can do that later. We've actually had guys who come through, and we've been marking these bugs so we can find them in a few months to work on them as, like, diagnostic clarity. And we have a couple of guys who are just going through them, like, one at a time, and just fixing, like, basically just the wording of our error messages, or, like, the error messages, like, we have an error message about inheritance, but it's, like, on the brace instead of on the class token. Like, people have just, like, been methodical in going through those things and fixing them. We've had people who have come through and said, like, your Linux build steps are wrong. Here is, like, how to build, like, your Linux build steps don't work for this obscure version of Linux. Like, this will fix this. We've had people actually start PRing compiler features, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
We've had people who have just done very basic bug fixes. We've had a couple people who've done very involved bug fixes. We had one guy who pointed out that the diffing routine that we use for, like, when you're typing into a file, when you paste the code, like, that comes across as a text diff. Like, someone inserted a bunch of text, someone deleted a bunch of text, and then we have to translate that into diffs, and eventually we update the parser and get new trees. And efficiency in that is key, because we want to do the minimal amount of work on every keystroke. This guy gave us a new diffing routine. Pointed out that, like, this was, it could be done much more efficiently. And when we first got that PR, we were like, nah, like, really? And then we went and looked at it, and we're like, oh my God, like, that is great. Like, that guy actually, like, fixed all those problems.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it was really impressive.
So the community is actually, I like that, the sense that it feels like C# is a great language. VB is a great language. It's great that now the community has access to making it even better through the compiler. So you mentioned something about Linux, which was kind of an interesting sort of perk in my ears. Does Roslyn actually work on Linux, or what do you mean by Linux? Yeah.
So Roslyn is developed in layers. So the Roslyn code base actually comes down to a couple layers. We kind of have the core of Roslyn, which this is basically our parsers, our bind, like, all the semantic information, syntax, semantic, emitting DLLs. And so this is basically what the compilers and the IDE all sits on top of. And we have kind of our workspaces layer. And workspaces is very similar to what you would think of, like, a Visual Studio solution. Okay. It's a collection of projects. It's basically a collection of projects, which is a collection of files, a collection of these. This all targets the portable subset. All the way, our compilers, basically workspaces and down, targets the portable subset in .NET. Which means that it's cross-platform and works, in theory, on Mono and any other language. I mean, every runtime has their quirks, and we have to adopt them. But all the way down from here actually can run on Linux, Mac, or what have you. And the compilers, we actively support and test this. So part of like making a change to our code base is we actually run a Jenkins suite on Windows and a Jenkins suite on Linux and Mac. And we do the same thing where we compile the compiler on Linux, we put it onto the side, and then we recompile our code base using that compiler.
Interesting.
And so it's not all of our code, though. So there is like Visual Studio.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, a little bit tied to Windows. And so that...
Visual Studio.
Visual Studio. Yeah. This is where Jared can't spell. and so like there is a part of our code base which is not cross-platform, but a good subset of it is, and we're constantly pushing down on that, pushing more and more into our portable layers as we're working with teams like OmniSharp to provide better cross-platform edit experiences, or VS Code, and essentially integrating our language services over there. And we do, right now, we do most of our testing on Mono. We're in the process of, we've been in the process of moving a lot of our infrastructure to Core CLR.
That was my next question.
Yes. And actually, today, if you go in Linux or Mac, whenever you run our make, essentially on Linux and Mac, like you're running the Core CLR, because we actually have a Core CLR tool set that we download when you run make, and then we essentially build another Core CLR compiler and just start running it.
Interesting.
Yeah. And we've got probably the majority of the C-sharp unit test run on every check-in on Mono, about a fifth of the VB test run. The only reason we don't have more of those is we kind of did a lot of that as a proof of concept, make sure that we can run on Mono, make sure that we are getting a cross-platform experience so ASP.NET can continue working,
right,
since they host a lot of this layer in ASP core now, essentially in terms of how they do their web pages. And so we were, there are a lot of onus on us to get our Mono and Linux infrastructure up and running, because we wanted to make sure we weren't breaking Mono, as opposed to the old way where we'd check in something, we'd break Mono, ASP.NET would pick it up 2 days later and then yell at us on Friday that we broke something on Monday.
So for Core CLR, because when you talk about the portable, there's so many different, like, there's portable profile 259, portable profile this plus that plus that plus that, right? When you mean portable, what do you mean? Do you mean Core CLR? Do you mean like...
Right now, the main code base targets profile 7, essentially.
Which is pretty low.
Yeah, it's very, it's the maximum portability. We will, at some point, when we go to, when we move to Roslyn 2.0, I think we'll move to net standard 1.3 or 1.4.
Nice.
But, yeah, but there's some outside constraints that keep us on profile 7 for basically anything that would go into Visual Studio 2015.
Got it.
Past that, though, the constraints lift a little bit and we can kind of move out.
And that actually makes sense, right? Because if you're building something, you've got to be able to target the lowest profile, because eventually someone's going to want to build something, and if Roslyn can't compile it, you have a problem.
Exactly.
That's awesome. Well, where can people go to find out more about Roslyn and then also learn how to contribute to Roslyn?
Go straight to our GitHub site, github.com.net/Roslyn.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much. We'll have to do this again, talk about more specific things, bud.
Absolutely. It's great talking to you.
Again, we're here in Building 25 talking about Roslyn. It's a freaking awesome thing, and I don't say that very often. My name is Seth Juarez, Channel 9. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.